Car Talk, I'm Scott Labar. June 6, 1944, 75 years ago today, the Allied forces of the United States, Great Britain, and Canada, along with close to 30 other nations, launched the largest amphibious military invasion in history on what is now known as D-Day. It was the beginning of the end for Nazi Germany in Europe and eventually led to an Allied victory and German surrender less than a year later. American General Dwight D. Eisenhower was the Allied Supreme Commander and made the important decisions that led to D-Day. On this anniversary, Smart Talk is on a road trip to the Eisenhower National Historic Site in Gettysburg, more commonly called the Eisenhower Farm, at least it is locally. It's General and then President Eisenhower's retirement, where he retired to after his 8 years in the White House. On today's show, we'll be talking about D-Day. We'll be talking about General and President Eisenhower a whole lot today. Joining us is John Heiser, historian at the Gettysburg National Military Park. Mr. Heiser, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Scott.
Michael Berkner is a professor of history at Gettysburg College. Professor Berkner, good to see you again.
Thank you, Scott.
And Tim Lambert, WYTF's multimedia news director, has worked in Gettysburg, has done a number of stories on World War II and D-Day, and he has one in particular that he worked on for this day, this occasion in particular, that we'll be discussing. Tim, always good to have you on the program.
Always a pleasure, Scott.
And we have a nice crowd here at the Gettysburg Farm. Can I call it the Gettysburg Farm?
Sure.
Okay. Eisenhower Farm.
I may interject. Did I call it the Gettysburg? Okay. Eisenhower Farm.
Eisenhower. Lots of farms in Gettysburg.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. And I want to tell our audience that if you have a question or a comment of any of our panelists, step right up to the microphone and we'll get you on the air. And because I know you have a lot of questions, a lot of people interested in history, interested in General and President Eisenhower. So join right in with our conversation. John Heiser, let me start with you. Let's go back to just before June 6, 1944. Dwight Eisenhower, as the Supreme Commander of the Allied Forces, had several big decisions to make. One had to do with weather, the actual date in which the invasion would take place, but there were a couple other decisions that had to be made as well. Like what?
General Eisenhower was probably in the worst position anybody can imagine, the weight of responsibility on his shoulders. It's not just dealing with the military operation, the planning, weather, air support, naval support, but he's also dealing with some very difficult personalities in Winston Churchill, for one, Sir Bernard Montgomery, the British commander, and many others who saw themselves more as the leaders of these invasions and this invasion force than the general himself. That's something about Eisenhower that we have to understand. He was excellent in dealing not just in the military side of it, but the political side and the social side of it. It's amazing that he was able to hold together this Allied force and coordinate for that one single day, because it was either now or never, and he said that.
Well, quite frankly, that's one of the reasons that Eisenhower was made the Supreme Commander, is that he could handle the other personalities diplomatically, correct?
Exactly. Yep.
And there were a lot of mixed feelings on some of the decisions being made. I mean, there had to be a decision of, we've all heard the stories, and we may hear it even today, of how the Allied forces tried to fake out the Germans of where the actual invasion would occur. But Eisenhower had to make that decision between Pas-de-Calais and of Normandy.
The selection of the beaches was a long, long process about what beach would be attacked by the British, the Canadian forces, and the American forces. The primary, when they switched from Calais to Normandy, it was those beaches that would best support the landing itself as well as the supporting craft that would come in. And thank God for things like the LST, the landing ship tank, and the LCI. These weapons of war, these naval vessels, could actually run right up on the beach and land and let troops off, supplies, to support the invasion itself. So those decisions were key elements in deciding which beaches would go where. And as a result, the bloodiest of them all would be Omaha Beach, which was actually thrown in kind of at the one of the last parts of the planning. Utah Beach would be the American effort with Point du Hoc thrown between. But the connection between Utah and Gold Juneau and Sword had to be that one section there called Omaha Beach, which we refer to today as Bloody Omaha.
Reason being that the Germans were well entrenched on what is now Omaha Beach. Obviously, these were code names.
Exactly.
That's in France. That wasn't known as Omaha Beach or Utah Beach or Juneau Beach ahead of time.
No.
These were code names, and there were even subcode names for the areas in which they would go.
Yes, one of them. Yes.
So, the day before what became D-Day, June 5th, 1944, Eisenhower is meeting with six other people. Only one is an American, General Omar Bradley. The rest are British. There were mixed feelings about whether to launch the invasion then. Tell us about that.
The problem was really the weather. You have so many, literally 100,000 men in ships, boats, crafts, ready to go. Some of them are already at sea. And if they don't go then, they're not going to go at all. But the problem was always the weather. The English Channel is always very hard to read. And if it hadn't been for Commander Stagg, who was the British officer in charge of the weather, he was the one who really made the decisions for Eisenhower to influence Eisenhower. But ultimately, the responsibility comes back on him. And as the general goes around the table that day and says, what do you think? What do you think? And actually, General Montgomery says, I say go, go, go. Well, that's the rash thing to do. The big responsibility is on Eisenhower's shoulders. And he takes, as he said, about maybe 30 seconds to think about it and says, okay, we'll go. And that's the decision. But once you say that and the room clears out, you have no control over what's going to happen that day. You trust your sub-commanders. You trust your corps commanders. You trust people like Bradley. But it goes right down to the corporals, the privates, the PFCs, the sergeants, the lieutenants who are on those landing craft, who are going to step on that beach that next day. They're the ones who are going to make it or break it. They're the ones who are going to decide that. And I'm always impressed by General Eisenhower, but not specifically what he said during that time, but 20 years later when he revisited Normandy with Walter Cronkite. And his comment was basically it was up to the ingenuity, the initiative of the GI. That was one of the day there because everything was going wrong.
There was a lot that went wrong, and we'll talk about that in just a moment. But Professor Michael Barkner, when we talk about the mixed feelings in that room, Eisenhower himself had doubts. In fact, he actually wrote two letters. Talk about that, if you would, his doubts and what he wrote.
Sure enough. Well, you're right. It's worth adding, and this is to piggyback on John's comment, in that room, while Montgomery does make the strong argument go, Lee Mallory, who's the air chief for the British, says there's going to be 80% casualties. Now, that's going to weigh pretty heavily on a commander. And others in the room were not enthusiastic about making this invasion at this time. So there was that. The whole scale of the operation was so enormous, and the Germans were so dug in and prepared. Rommel was no fool in the way that he defended the Normandy coast, that Eisenhower had to think that it was possible this would not work. And so, as you just suggest, he does write two letters, the first of them commending the soldiers to this crusade and expressing his confidence in their ingenuity and courage. And the second, which is probably even the more remarkable letter, is which he scratches out in pencil a note saying that the invasion, for all of the courage and tenacity of our men, has failed, and the responsibility lies on no one's shoulders but his own. That letter is in the Eisenhower Library in Abilene, Kansas. It's a remarkable document, and it says something about the character of Dwight Eisenhower.
You said that German General Rommel was no fool. But at the same time, and what Eisenhower didn't know at the time, was that the Germans were taken by surprise, that all the moves that the Allies had made in England preparing for the invasion and actually almost a second preparation to fool the Germans actually worked. I mean, yeah, they were taken by surprise, but not enough that they weren't shooting and all that. But the reason I bring that up is because Rommel was actually celebrating his birthday.
Wife's birthday.
Oh, it's wife's birthday. Okay. Celebrating his
More
wife's
important.
Birthday.
Yeah.
And for those who are
from Paris.
for those who have seen the movie The Longest Day, I'm sure there's some dramatic license taken there, but the German commanders were like, Normandy, like they were totally surprised by that. But Eisenhower didn't know that at the time, right?
He didn't know it, of course. And that's the thing about war, and that's the thing about something on this scale, is that contingency is the key word. When you think about Normandy and the invasion, you think about all the things that went right, and then you think about all the things that could have gone massively wrong. And you picked on one of the things. If Rommel and von Rundstedt had a better sense that Normandy was going to be the landing point, there would have been much more preparation for that specific invasion. In addition to that, you've got the fact that Hitler doesn't get awakened and allow the panzers to come in.
Yeah, they were afraid to wake him up.
They were afraid to wake him up. The business of the soldiers on the beach and their willingness to take what fire they had to take and to keep going. The fact that the weather broke at the right moment in the right way. All of these things, the fact that there were no real leaks to let the Germans in on what we were planning to do, so many contingencies. And that's one of the reasons why Eisenhower had a pretty bad stomach for much of the spring of 1944, because he couldn't know what was going to go on.
He was smoking a lot, too, if I understand.
He was a chain smoker, 5 packs a day.
Are there ashtrays here in the...
There were a few in the house, yeah.
Okay.
They're hidden. With the most infamously, he supposedly quit after his one heart attack, but they did find, in 1980, after she had passed away, they found cigarettes hidden away here and there. So there's some habits you just could not give up.
So even the former president of the United States was hiding away from his wife.
A mild deception, just like they see the Germans in World War II.
You know, things that could go wrong, there was a lot that went wrong. I mean, you've heard many people say that it was just sheer guts and number of people and the people who fought on D-Day to make it successful. But, John, what were some of the things that went wrong?
Let's look at Omaha, for example. The Army Air Corps that was going to bomb the beach, and supposedly the assaulting troops would know that there'd be craters in the beach they could take cover in. The initial aircraft attack completely failed. They missed the target. They dropped their bombs too late, so it fell further inshore. A lot of the naval preparatory bombardment failed as well because the emplacements were so well dug in and well placed around the draws off Omaha that they really did no harm at all to them, just a little bit of shaking up of a couple of German soldiers here and there. As devastating and powerful as all that was, by the time the first assault craft went ashore, and I always think of the first 3,000 guys in these LCVPs going ashore, and the ramps come down, and the first thing they see is no shell holes to crawl in. The wire is all still there. The mines, the barricades, everything is still there. And you compare it to going out to the middle of a field, football field, with nothing but mad hornets after you. But in this case, the hornets are shooting 8-millimeter rounds, 81-millimeter mortar rounds, 88-millimeter rounds. There's nowhere to go. It's a bloodbath. Mm-hmm. But there's somewhere in these guys, and for some of them who had never been in combat before, like in the 29th Division and some of those replacements in the 1st Division, it was literally hell on earth. It was their last day on earth. It's really remarkable. These men... And we're just talking about private sergeants. They've lost their officers, lost all their directions, landed in the wrong places. They just looked ahead. We got to get off this beach. And thank God for officers like Colonel Taylor of the 16th Infantry, Norman Cota of the 29th Infantry, and many others who just, we're going to get off this beach. We're going to do our job. And as scared as these guys were, look to the right and left of you. They were no different than we are today. They're 19, 20, 21-year-old guys up in their 30s, even 40s. They just had it in them. They weren't professional soldiers. They had been farmers, merchants, clerks, students before the war. And they're thrown in this terrible situation, armed with an M1 rifle, grenades, Bangalore torpedoes, carrying anywhere between 60 to 80 pounds of equipment, going ashore wet. They're seasick. They get on that beach. They're facing pure hell, nowhere to go but forward, or they stay there and they die.
In another example, Scott, of this point is the advanced group of paratroopers and glider pilots and their men coming in and, as John alluded, often being misguided or getting blown off course and winding up in places they either didn't know where they were or they didn't want to be because there were Germans right there, as was the case in St. Mary Glees. So you've got all this issue of people having to be able to think very fast on their feet and be able to respond to any particular emergency. And what they did was simply spectacular.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News. And all things regional, I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. We are on a Smart Talk road trip today at the Eisenhower, I don't want to say Gettysburg for some reason. Eisenhower National Historic Site in Gettysburg, as many people call it, the Eisenhower Farm. And on this 75th anniversary of D-Day, we're talking about General Eisenhower, plans for D-Day, how D-Day was carried out. A little bit later, we're going to be talking about General Eisenhower himself. He had a background here in Gettysburg. Not many people know that. From way back before World War II, talk about that, talk about his presidency, and talk about the farm when the Eisenhowers did retire to the Eisenhower farm after his presidency. Want to tell you that today's Smart Talk Road Trip live remote broadcast is supported by Roof Advisory Group. So I want to thank Roof Advisory Group for their support. Our guest during this portion of the program is John Heiser, a historian at Gettysburg National Military Park, Michael Berkner, who is a professor of history at Gettysburg College, and Tim Lambert, WITF's multimedia news director. And Tim, you always, this has been one of your hobbies over the years as a history buff, but D-Day, World War II, but D-Day in particular, and you've been to Normandy several times, right?
Yes, I have.
So I'm just curious, I just came back from there, the first time I was there, your observations and what you learned from actually being there.
I think my experiences have sort of been colored by living here in Gettysburg for 7 years as well. So, you know, having the opportunity to walk the battlefield, ride the battlefield when it's not tourist season, and you can go up to Culp's Hill and no one's around. You can stand on Pickett's Charge Field and no one's around. So, you know, we're talking about a three-day battle in a confined area. And when you get to Normandy, those five beaches stretch 50, 60 miles, let alone where the paratroopers dropped in, both in the British and the Americans. So they were farther inland and they were scattered all over. So this is a wide swath where you can't see everything you need to see in Normandy within a day, maybe not even in a week. But one of the big things for me was standing at low tide at the edge of on Omaha Beach, and you stand at the water's edge and you look at 100 yards, 200 yards, 300 yards to any sort of cover, any sort of protection that those guys would have had. And you think, how in the world would I run across this beach soaked to the bone carrying 70 pounds of equipment while basically a swarm of bees is around? That's what it sounded like to some veterans. That's how much fire was being thrown at them by the Germans up on the bluffs. So that was a very humbling thing to think about and stand and watch that. And then you sort of look at the water and you think, at that day, this was red with blood of American soldiers. And the other thing would be that going to the cemetery itself, 9,000 plus crosses of Star of David's and crosses there, all facing west, all facing where they came from America. And the French flags being on, I think, the left, which would signify French soil, and on the right towards America. And I learned through some reporting on a story I did a few years ago that the state with the most men and women buried at that cemetery is Pennsylvania. So that was the extra humbling for me. And just to look at the names and where they came from and the ages was something that, you know, stays with you. And then getting out further, too, you talk about Pegasus Bridge, probably the only operation of the entire D-Day plan that actually went right. Everything else after that sort of blew up, and it was every man for himself. But to think about how Pegasus Bridge and the gliders that landed within yards of that, and those British paratroopers were on top of the Germans before they even knew what happened. So you really get a sense of the scope and the scale of that. And then, you know, of course, this was the beginning of the end of Nazi Germany. This was the beginning of the liberation of Europe. And to see the French people still to this day appreciate what those men and women did was something that also was very powerful. I mean, you drive down old lanes and farmhouses, and you see American flags in the right. window and by their mailboxes, and you know, it just makes you feel proud of what was done.
After being there just 4 weeks ago, I can say that, you know, obviously D-Day, the 75th anniversary, is getting a lot of attention here in the United States and worldwide. But in France, it is almost like a national holiday. And, you know, one of the things that I wanted to bring up before we get to Tim's story is that 75, you know, we commemorate these even-numbered or every 5 years, every 20-year kind of anniversaries. Many people would think that 100 would be when the big commemoration would be for D-Day. What you have to be reminded of is that there probably, almost certainly, will be no living veterans alive 100 years after D-Day. So 75 takes on more significance, quite like what happened here at Gettysburg, the 75th anniversary after the Battle of Gettysburg. Tim, you have been working for the last few weeks on a story that I know is near and dear to your heart, that just an excellent story about one soldier in particular from Pennsylvania on D-Day, well, actually the day after D-Day, which a lot of people won't know when they see the photograph, but then some other people that are involved too. Set it up if you would.
So there's the famous photo. It's a black and white photo of an American soldier being dragged out of the English Channel. He's basically being held up by two American soldiers, and he's limp. He looks older. He's a balding soldier, so you're wondering, who is this? How did he end up in the military? Not quite what you picture a World War II soldier to look like. But you can tell he's done. He's near the end. You know, he's struggling to even survive. So this photo has always been in commemorative magazines and documentaries, in any history books about D-Day. And the photo is always identified as June 6th and the American troops at Omaha. Well, the photo was taken on June 7th. And you might wonder, who are these people? Because the men in that photo have never been identified. So a few years ago, a friend of the family, his name's George Gott, he lives in Swickley, Pennsylvania, outside of Pittsburgh. He comes up to me because he knew I had a history interest, and he said, you know, I've been researching this photo. I know the guy who's in the photo. He was interviewed in Pittsburgh on the 50th anniversary of D-Day. So I called him up and I talked to him. And as we talked, I was able to get more information about the people involved and who he saw on the beach that day. So he said, I can't do anything with it. You're the writer. See what you can do. Maybe there's a book in it. Maybe there's a magazine article. So I was like, oh, wow, this would be my dream to write a story about D-Day. Like, you know, who does that? Only historians, real historians and researchers. So this would be great. So I took it on, and I've been dabbling in it for the last couple of years with the news cycle being the way it is. I don't have a lot of free time. But so I managed to put together a series of notes on what George had put together. And there were scraps of paper. He's not a journalist. So there's these scraps of yellow paper that he scribbled on, and he didn't, you know, wasn't transcribing his interviews. It's just little quotations here and there. So when the 75th anniversary was approaching, I thought, now's the time that's going to give me the kick in the butt to actually write this thing. So I sat down to do it, and the soldier's name is Nicholas Russin, and Private First Class Russin's from Lindora, Pennsylvania, in Butler County. He's the man being dragged out of the water. He's the man, when you see that photo, nobody ever knows who he is. So Nick is going in on June 7th. He is a replacement soldier. He is with the 5th Brigade, Engineer Special Brigade. And so Nick's journey begins on June 7th. So he starts to climb down the rope into the landing craft. And lo and behold, as he gets into the landing craft, who does he run into? He runs into a Navy second-class signalman by the name of John Furka. John Furka is Nick's best friend from Lindora. They enlisted together in March 1943 in Pittsburgh, and one went into the Army, one went into the Navy. They haven't seen each other since. John Furka had been taking these landing crafts, part of the crew there, into D-Day from the first wave till now. So John said in an interview that he had taken three men in from Lindora during this time. One did not make it back. One was Nick Russin. The other one, name is lost to history. But so as they're traveling in, the pilot of this landing craft sees a sandbar coming up and says, I'm going to put the ramp down so I can see. Do not jump. Don't jump. For whatever reason, Nick didn't hear it. The waves were crashing. German artillery's falling. Soldiers are nervously talking. Nick jumps in the water. and goes straight to the bottom of the English Channel, about 8 to 10 feet down, 80 pounds of gear. So he pushes off the seafloor, he surfaces, he's trying to breathe, and John Furka, being the quick-thinking Navy man, gets a gaff with a hook on the end of it, fishes Nick out of the water. So before Nick has even touched down on French soil, he almost died, thanks to his best friend who happened to be there. So they go on in, and whatever happened to the craft is sort of up in the air. I couldn't clarify whether it was hit by artillery fire, whether it was took in too much water and started to sink, whether it just hit a sandbar. There's film that was taken by some photographers, which we'll get to in a moment. But for whatever reason, Nick ends up in the water again, and he's struggling along with some of these other soldiers. And so this is where we'll pick up where the rescuers come in. So one of the rescuers was Second Lieutenant Walter Sidlowski. He was with the 348th Engineer C Battalion of the 5th Engineer Special Brigade. Walter Sidlowski ended up with a Bronze Star out of this whole rescue. But he landed in the second wave on Omaha Beach and encountered basically hell. Bodies everywhere, and the funny thing is, well, not funny, but one of the things was, as he was riding in on his landing craft the day before, he took a sip of coffee from that was offered to him, and he had a cracked tooth that he had earlier, and he couldn't get it fixed because all the dental stuff was packed up to go set up in Normandy. So he had this cracked tooth, drinks coffee, intense pain. He's about to enter a war zone. And so that was how Walter Sidlowski's war started in France. So fast forward, and Sidlowski is on the beach with a group of other soldiers from the Engineers Battalion Brigade, and they decide we're going to save these guys in the landing craft out there. So a couple guys get a rope, and they swim out to the landing craft and tie the rope there so the guys can walk themselves in. There's rubber rafts all over because supplies were everywhere from the chaos of Omaha Beach. They grab these rubber rafts, they go out, and they rescue men as well. So there's famous photos of this entire sequence, probably the most famous rescue sequence or sequence of the war that were taken. So the photographers, there were three of them on the beach. One was Private Louis Weintraub, who took the famous photo of Nick coming out of the surf. One was Sergeant Val Pope, who was a movie photographer, so he's filming it all. And the other was Private First Class Walter Rosenblum, who ended up becoming one of the most decorated photographers of the war. He earned the Silver Star, the Bronze Star. He had 5 battle stars and a Purple Heart. So they just point their cameras at this rescue. They're just stunned at what's happening. And just a little background on the photographers is they were there in the second wave as too. They went in basically with Walter Sidlowski, snapping pictures, shooting film. That night on June 6th, they wrote some captions out for their editors. They put their film up on a landing craft. No one knows what happened to that film. Gone. No, the history, for whatever reason, never made it back. So you'd think, like, they've captured all these amazing images of Omaha Beach, and there aren't many from the actual action on the beach. You've seen it from the landing crafts and some film, but so that's gone. But here they have this opportunity, and they take advantage to take this just amazing sequence. So as this rubber raft is coming in, and you see this series of photos, and you see the film from Walter Pope, Val Pope, and you see Nick Russin on the side of it, and he's just struggling, and he's struggling, and all of a sudden, right before the film cuts off, Nick goes in the water, and he's 4 feet from the shore, but he just can't make it anymore. Nick says he blacks out, thought he was going to die. Next thing he knows, he ends up on the beach, thanks to some of the guys there who went in and pulled him out, and they get him onto the beach, and the photos just tell the tale. And one of the things that was so great about what we've been able to do with this story is we have the film from Val Pope on our website, and we have some of the photos that were taken that day too. So
at WITF.org. Yeah. We also we have Private Rosenblum.
Yes.
At that time.
Yes.
Okay. We have some on as part of the story. We hear from him. Let's listen to that now.
The Germans were in the hills overlooking the beach. They'd zeroed in on the beach, and so people were being killed around me. I'd never seen a dead person before. And suddenly, there are dead people in the water. The water's turning red. They're being washed up and down by the sea. And I was still figuring, I'm still around, and I began to take pictures of whatever it is I saw.
You know, one of the things that strikes me about that is that it's one thing to be, you're being shot at, you're in the water, you're charging those, that high ground the Germans are on. It's another to be holding a camera. And that's your weapon, if that's how you want to refer to it. But I think that is a good description of what, now that he, I think he was talking about the D-Day itself, June 6th, but just a good description of what it was like on Omaha Beach.
Yeah, and there's actually a documentary that his daughter and her husband made. They fought with cameras. And you know, while those guys were running towards the beach, the cameramen were facing the beach. So the firing's coming from behind, and some photographers were wounded during the invasion. Val Pope ended up being killed 3 months later with when Walter Rosenblum was with him, killed by a sniper. So there was a lot of sacrifice on that end as well, and a lot of courage to do that. And one of the reasons why they know that this photo was taken on June 7th is Walter Rosenblum took a picture of Sidlowski, another famous photo where Sidlowski is sort of, you know, they're zoomed in on him, and Sidlowski has this, like, Burt Lancaster look, like the epitome of a soldier, a heroic soldier, and he's sort of slumping over, whether it's a dead or wounded soldier, you can't tell, it's just the boots you see under a blanket, and he's looking up, and he has this, like, look of resignation, of sadness, of you know, just like, oh, I this is amazing, you know, going through this is just something. And so they took this photo of Sidlowski as well. And so that's another famous photo that they took, and just amazing work of what they did.
Well, but you started to talk about the reason, you know, it was on.
Oh yeah,
June
so
7th.
In this,
yeah.
I ramble so much. So all this stuff is in my head. So in the background of this photo, there's an officer standing up, not wearing a helmet, and he's smoking a cigarette. And Sidlowski, a few years later, said there is no way on June 6th, 1944, that any officer would have been smoking, let alone standing up without his helmet on under that kind of fire. So pretty clear indication of when that photo was taken.
Tim got a good job of summarizing this story, but if you'd like to read the whole story, see the video, see the photographs, it's just it's a great story.
Thank you.
Go to WITF.org or PAPost.org. And you could read the story. But, gentlemen, I want to thank you very much for being with us today. Tim Lambert, WITS Multimedia News Director. John Heiser, historian at Gettysburg National Military Park. Michael Berkner is going to stay with us here for a few minutes. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Sure.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. We are on a Smart Talk road trip today at the Eisenhower National Historic Site in Gettysburg. A lot of the people here in central Pennsylvania refer to it as the Eisenhower Farm. And if you've never been here before, highly encourage you. The farm is laid out much like it was when the Eisenhowers were living here in the 1960s and well, not into the 70s, but in the 1960s. There's still the putting green that President Eisenhower had installed out back where he practiced his putting. And that's just one, you know, I always look down where we are. We're outside. You look down to the right, there's a patio here. And on that patio, the Eisenhowers hosted Winston Churchill. I think Khrushchev was here.
Yes,
yeah.
Khrushchev was here.
Yeah, Khrushchev was here. If I remember correctly, he was like wearing shorts or something. I don't think he should have done.
No, I don't think so.
Okay, I got to get that vision out of my mind then, you know? But anyway, if you've never been here, you should visit the Eisenhower National Historic Site. We're doing it here on the 75th anniversary of D-Day. And I should mention to you that today's Smart Talk Road Trip live remote broadcast is supported by Roof Advisory Group. Dwight Eisenhower's retirement to Gettysburg was not the first time that he was here in Gettysburg. He trained on tanks during World War I at Camp Colt. Historians often underrated Eisenhower's presidency, but in hindsight, his stock is rising. In fact, the latest ranking of presidents by historians compiled by C-SPAN ranked Eisenhower as the nation's fifth best president, and he's moved up more than any other president on that list. To talk about President Eisenhower's life are Alice Evans, a park ranger for the Eisenhower National Historic Site. Ms. Evans, welcome to the program.
Hi, Scott.
And Michael Berkner, still with us, professor of history at Gettysburg College.
Glad to be here.
All right, so let's go back to when Eisenhower was here in Gettysburg. Camp Colt, where was Camp Colt?
Camp Colt was actually on the fields of Pickett's Charge. I think a lot of our visitors are very surprised at the idea that there'd be a military encampment on such sacred ground. But during World War I, all sort of battlefields and areas that could be used for the war effort were utilized, like here in Gettysburg.
When you say Camp Colt to people, a lot of central Pennsylvanians, most of them really don't recognize it, do they?
No. I think it's one of our best-kept secrets. It's a really important part of our history here in Gettysburg. And, you know, then Captain Eisenhower was here from March until November of 1918. So the time that Eisenhower spent here was longer than, you know, the Union and Confederate soldiers spent in Gettysburg in 1863. So I think it's a really important moment in Gettysburg's history.
So Captain Eisenhower, he really didn't like it, though, did he?
No. Unfortunately for Captain Eisenhower, he had wanted to get overseas to fight in France, and he's going to end up remaining stateside for the entire war effort, training other soldiers to go over to the trenches of France. So when World War One ended, he was convinced he'd have no war stories to tell.
On the other hand, Scott, that's very true, but he also made lemonade out of that lemon of not getting abroad because he got experience that was important executive experience for him. He got to work with tanks, which were going to be the new thing in warfare, and he dealt with challenges that were quite severe, notably the flu pandemic in Gettysburg, and handled that about as well as anybody could have. He actually commandeered space in town for his soldiers to be treated, including St. Francis Church on High Street. He dealt with various British and other officers who came in to learn about tanks. He made friends with people like George Patton. So he had an opportunity, I think, to grow during this period, as well as having a very happy family life at that time.
Well, see, that's the point I was going to bring up next, is that I said that he really didn't like his time. It wasn't Gettysburg he didn't like. It was where he was in his life and in his military career, because obviously he liked Gettysburg enough that he bought a house here, bought a farm, and came back. So what did Eisenhower do after World War One?
After World War One, he sort of goes, you know, all around the world. Of course, we're getting close to the anniversary of the 1919 convoy, where he traveled cross-country with a military convoy to see how quickly the Army could utilize soldiers from one side of the country in case of emergency, which, of course, is going to plant a little seed, which would have come to a full bloom when he's president in 1956. He's going to spend time in Panama. He'll spend time in the Philippines, as well as all around the country. And I think in some ways he wouldn't have said that that was a disappointment as well, but he's going to come to the attention of many important figures, least, of course, most importantly, General Marshall. I think there's going to be very key figures in his life during this time period that help to promote him as an officer and will eventually, of course, help him achieve the rank of general.
Yeah, General George Marshall back here in the States that kind of ran the war for Roosevelt from stateside anyway, and of course his name attached to the Marshall Plan after for Europe after World War II. So Professor Berkner, let's talk about World War II. Once Eisenhower is promoted, how does he become Allied Supreme Commander?
Well, I think he becomes Allied Supreme Commander because he has qualities that no other individual among other generals had, and that was the ability to get along with everybody, the ability to subjugate nationalistic feelings to the common cause. That was his great mantra, and I think that was something that appealed both to Churchill and to Roosevelt. He had this je ne sais quoi, you know, quality about him where people who met Eisenhower liked him. I'm not saying every British general respected him. Alan Brooke was a constant naysayer, and there were others. But when it came right down to it, he knew how to manage men up and manage superiors as well. And he kept his cool. He was a person, despite, as we discussed in the first segment, smoking and drinking coffee constantly and living on bologna sandwiches, he manages to keep things going. So I think it's his personal qualities that really make him rise.
We went through Eisenhower's decision making for D-Day and World War II. After World War II, you know, 5 years later, there's a conflict in Korea. Eisenhower is called back, and a little known part of his career is in Korea, but is involved in the Korean conflict as well. At that time, and in American history, we often look to our heroes, our military heroes, as politicians. Maybe not anymore, but we did at that time. So Eisenhower looked upon as the hero, one of the heroes of D-Day, of World War II. Both Democrats and Republicans wanted to draft Eisenhower to run for office. In fact, many people didn't know whether he was Republican or a Democrat. So how does he decide to run for president, and why as a Republican?
I think World War II has a lot to do with why he decides that he will stand for president. He was worried that his party, and by 1949, he was clearly in the camp of the Republican Party. Eisenhower sees that there's a large portion of the Republican Party that wants to disassociate itself from the European alliance by not supporting it financially or providing the military help that it needs in order to respond to any Soviet potential aggression in Western Europe. Eisenhower wants an internationalist, he wants a collaborationist, he wants a European-American condominium to support Western civilization and the values of democracy. And he's worried that this might lose. And the Democratic Party is not the vehicle for him, because he thinks the Democratic Party has become a paternalist party and essentially is engaged in a kind of a drift towards socialism. And so he finds it a comfort zone to be a Republican, but an internationalist Republican, and he'll hang his hat on that banner.
Alice Evans, the Eisenhowers bought this farm in 1950. Mm-hmm. What was it like at that time when he bought the farm?
Well, it was your typical farm, you know, out in the countryside here in Gettysburg. The family that owned the farm before the Eisenhowers, the Reddings, they were a little, you know, up in years, and their family were not interested in continuing with farming. So there was a lot of things that appealed to General Eisenhower about this farm. First off, its location. You know, we're literally right next door to the battlefield. His property line was the historic Gettysburg National Military Park. So he had that Civil War history right there. But also, it was a farm that kind of needed help. You know, it had gotten a little bit run down in the last years of the Reddings being here. And General Eisenhower was not the sort of person that just wanted to sit around in retirement and be bored. He wanted another challenge. So a farm that needed a little bit of fixing up sounded just about ideal to him.
How many acres?
He purchased 189 acres.
Four?
44,000 in 1950. So.
Everyone kind of giggles at that. That's why I had to ask.
I think you should add, Scott, that he had somebody else handle this so that the price would not be higher.
Yeah.
Probably a good idea. How often when President Eisenhower was president, did they visit Gettysburg?
We can document that President Eisenhower was on the farm at least 360 days out of his presidency. So it tells you immediately what an important spot this was for him.
There are places, I know he has a den, there's mm-hmm. an office where there's a desk that a lot of important decisions were made during the 1950s, during the Eisenhower presidency, from this farm, mm-hmm. from this spot. Like what?
Well, I think, you know, probably the most important and sort of stressful moment, it's kind of twofold. You know, of course, he invited Nikita Khrushchev here to
right,
this country.
Right. And he wasn't wearing shorts.
No. But that was a very important moment because they connected us as individuals here on the farm. I think that truly helped, you know, relations for a while. But tragically, of course, about, you know, half a year after Khrushchev's here, the U-2 spy incident will occur. And President Eisenhower was in this home when it was confirmed to him that the pilot was alive. They knew the plane was missing, but he was here on his farm when it was confirmed to him that Francis Gary Powers was still alive and in a Soviet prison. So I think that was a kind of make it or break it moment for Eisenhower's presidency. What was he going to do now that we could no longer bluff? And of course, he chooses to stand up and say that, yes, you know, he knew about this plane, he signed off on it. And it's sort of a disappointing moment for him as president. Mm.
So, Professor Berkner, what kind of president was Eisenhower?
Effective, much more so than perhaps contemporary analysts and political scientists were giving him credit for, because they were so used to the Roosevelt-Truman years, where there was just a constant barrage of bills going through Congress and where there was a sense that the president was always on the front lines. And Eisenhower tended to work a little bit more back channel. Eisenhower also was giving the public what it wanted. Think about these D-Day veterans coming back to the United States at the end of the war. What do they want to do? They want to start fresh. They want to marry. They want to get more education. They want to go back to jobs. They want to raise families. They want to become good citizens of their communities. They want to cultivate their own gardens. A president who can rise above the fray, and there was a fray in this country over communism and over the role of government. Eisenhower was a bit of a not nonpartisan president, but almost above partisanship president in the eyes of many of these GIs who really liked him a lot. They're the reason he was so popular and was reelected so easily in 56. So I think as far as being right for his times, Eisenhower suited. And let me add here that he was president for 8 years, where the GNP grew over a third, where there was a minor recession and a major recession, but by and large, the quality of life grew for most Americans, where we have the beginnings of the civil rights movement, where he actually plays a more positive role than people think he does. And in general, you're at peace. Those are pretty good credentials for an effective presidency.
In the years after Eisenhower was president, and I do mean 20, 30 years, many historians did not view kindly Eisenhower's presidency, or, you know, they put him in the middle of the pack. They didn't, even though he could bank on those statistics. Many people looked at the 50s as, oh, okay, it was a boring decade, and Eisenhower was a boring person. He was happy to go putt on his putting green or play golf with Bob Hope, that kind of thing. But as I said in my introduction, C-SPAN, ranking of the presidents, he is now ranked fifth, the fifth best president in the history of the United States, and has moved up higher than any other president. Why?
Well, I'll take one stab at it. Alice might have a thought on this, too. We have to recognize that our mood and our attitudes about certain things have changed. So, for example, presidents who were slave owners and who were aggressively in favor of advancing slave interests in this country, and think about people like Jackson and Polk, and, of course, Thomas Jefferson with his Sally Hemings story. These presidents have lost traction with many historians. But I think the most important reason that Eisenhower's grown in stature is that, with the perspective of time, can anybody say that we've had a better president since World War II than Dwight Eisenhower? Is there any argument to be made for that? Hard to find that argument. No great scandals, no great crises, no wars that were stupid. Eisenhower led the country effectively. The second part of it is that as scholars have dug into the documents, which are available in the Eisenhower Library primarily, they've discovered that this was a much more engaged, canny, and even manipulative president than anybody had ever imagined, and that he was the puppet master rather than, as you say, the common image of the guy who's just putting on the putting green. So historians have gained a greater appreciation for the degree to which Eisenhower was in charge.
Alice, we only have a minute left. I want to thank you very much for being with us today, all of you for being with us today. Post-presidency, the Eisenhowers were here after 1960 to when Ike died in 1969. Mm-hmm. What was life like?
In many ways, life was sort of, this was the reward he received for years and years of service. He was finally able to live in his own home. This is the only home they ever owned in their 50 years of marriage. Watch his grandchildren grow up, a privilege that he took very seriously, because he knew many families would never have that privilege because their only son was buried in a cemetery in Normandy. So he was always grateful, I think, for what his country had given him.
Alice Evans is a park ranger with the Eisenhower National Historic Site. Michael Berkner is a professor of history at Gettysburg College. Thank both of you for being with us today.
Thank you for having us.
And on this 75th anniversary of D-Day, there will be a lot more coverage from NPR and throughout the day on WITF, so stay tuned to WITF. But I want to thank the Eisenhower Historic Site for having us here today, and thank our audience for being with us as well. Coming up tomorrow, we have the author of a book, best-selling book, that takes a look at something that is kind of considered common knowledge as how you become a skilled person or really good at something. And it's maybe not the way that we think it is. That's coming up on tomorrow's program. So we'll talk to you then. Have a good day.